it's still perfectly legitimate to remind the government, a government that has not been responsive, that their issues have not been addressed.
Hong Kong democracy advocates win big at the polls. It's Tuesday, November 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, paddling for the environment, shifting to the west in the South China Sea, solar cranberries, qualifications for ambassadors, and the political glass ceiling. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong's leader said she respects the results of local elections in which pro-democracy forces scored a sweeping victory and said she would reflect on them seriously. Beijing-friendly executive Carrie Lam issued a statement Monday saying the government would listen humbly to the opinions of the members of the public after Sunday's local elections that saw a record number of voters deliver a stunning rebuke to Beijing. During Sunday's elections, opposition candidates won nearly 90% of contested seats, that according to public broadcaster RTHK. The Democrats will now control 17 of 18 district councils after having previously controlled none. The vote was a major symbolic blow to pro-China forces that dominate Hong Kong politics and the latest evidence of continued public support for a five-month-old pro-democracy movement that has become increasingly aggressive. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with Professor Timothy Cheek. He is Director of Asian Research at the University of British Columbia. Melman asked the professor his reaction to the election results.
I was happily surprised, both by the turnout, the peacefulness, and by the likely results that, strong support for candidates associated with the demonstrations or democracy or democratic leaning. It was the only good news we've had out of Hong Kong in quite a while.
Is there any way whatsoever that the results of the election and those elected who are part of the democracy movement and the protesters will have a valid say in the government?
Only in a limited way. But what's important is that I think what has been driving the ongoing demonstrations and even some of the turn towards violence is the utter frustration, desperation, and despair that young people feel in Hong Kong, that they just don't have a voice, that Beijing just doesn't care, and that nothing they can do within the system is going to make any difference. That they turned around and supported these elections with a very high turnout, what I think 71% versus 48% last time, and got a pretty good hit in terms of getting people they wanted elected, I can only hope will be a positive sign that it's worth trying to find a way to work through some organizational way, as opposed to on the street, to address these ongoing and real concerns that the people of Hong Kong have.
So what do you think is going to happen? Will there be renewed protest or not?
Boy, the honest answer is I don't know. I suspect there will be, but what I'll be looking for is the intensity, size, and the amount of violence. It's still perfectly legitimate to remind the government, a government that has not been responsive, that their issues have not been addressed. But this, even this small incremental ability to express their voice and have it recognized. Now, if the Beijing government turns around and throws out some of the elected Democratic candidates or otherwise is sort of unilateral and hard-handed, all hell will break loose.
And what's the possibility of that? Do you have any inside information? And if not, just give me how you feel about it.
Boy, I wish I had inside information and the information was good. What I do have is, I'll call it a slightly higher grader gossip amongst the scholars. And there is a feeling that you call them factions or divisions or sections within the government in Beijing. But it is clear, particularly by the restraint that the Beijing government showed around National Day in October 1, that there are voices in the Chinese government that says you cannot go to the wall on this, that they want to find a solution that is something short of another Tiananmen. Whether they will prevail or whether hotheads or hardliners will prevail, we just don't know. It's really, really anxiety provoking.
it is really a toss-up, is it not? No one really does know, except maybe those who are going to make the decision, and there are chances they don't know yet either, right?
Exactly, because the Hong Kong protests are almost unprecedented in that they are a truly social movement without leaders. This is the frustration of an entire society. When you have 1 million, 2 million people on the streets, you know, that is just, you know, there's always a Beijing speaker that says, oh, the CIA is funding this. And one of my colleagues responded and said, well, thank you for the compliment. CIA is almost never this successful. And, you know, it's a joke. This is a social movement from the Hong Kong people. And that's a powerful and wonderful thing to see. But the downside is there's no leaders to negotiate with. And that's what we need to have now. There needs to be a climb down and a way to negotiate to get these problems addressed. And because as long as the government continues to stonewall, there will be demonstrations.
Beijing has already voiced its support for Carrie Lam. What do you think is going to happen as far as she is concerned?
Well, you know, there's never been a chief executive that's done well, because the system under one country, two systems, and the way that Beijing wants to run it, you know, are at odds. And so, you know, Carrie Lam's already made it clear she'd like to step down. And of course, Beijing won't let her. The current gossip among scholars is that they will let her step down after the two meetings in March, you know, of the National People's Congress and the Consultative Congress. But they want a decent interval after street demonstrations stop.
Do you expect any movement, a possible movement from China to have a greater sense of democracy?
Ultimately, no. But I do think that the Communist Party has in the past, from time to time, been very pragmatic. And if pragmatic voices will go, they will offer some short-term solutions, some short-term ability. The government in China, the Communist Party government, has allowed certain kinds of local democracies around the country from time to time, as long as it doesn't challenge their rule. And so, you know, the problem is that the hardline tactics of the past 6 months have alienated the young people. They might have been willing to try some compromise, consultative, something or other 6 months ago. But the problem now is what the party is likely to offer and what it has historically offered in broadly comparable situations is not enough. I am deeply worried about what's going to happen.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Professor Timothy Cheek at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. Hong Kong leader to seriously reflect on election results after landslide pro-democracy win. China's netizens snub state media's interpretation of Hong Kong election results. Details leak from China's mass detention camps in Xinjiang. U.S. official blasts concentration camps. Two Asian allies reweigh their China ties as territorial disputes grow. Nations aim for inclusive trade. Vietnam uses small business loans to get there. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you make a visit to Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coast-to-coast paddling protesters have taken to the ocean to demonstrate against a Norwegian mining company's plans to drill for oil off South Australia. Environmentalists say marine life is at risk, but the industry insists drilling can be safe. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Great Australian Bight is a wide-open bay off the continent's southern coastline. Conservationists say it's one of the most stunning marine environments in the world, with the planet's largest population of southern right whales. It's also home to sea lions, dolphins and penguins. It's also of interest to the resources industry. A Norwegian company, Equinor, wants to drill a well 370 kilometres from the coast in search of oil. There has been petroleum exploration in the Great Australian Bight since the late 1960s. The South Australian state government has said there's been no reported or identified environmental harm in the last 50 years. But never before has drilling taken place at a depth of more than 2 kilometres, which is what Equinor has proposed. Environmentalists on surfboards have held rallies around Australia. There were more than 50 so-called paddleouts, including at Port Lincoln in South Australia, Bondi Beach in Sydney, and Townsville in Queensland. There are fears about the potential for oil spills and damage to the local fishing and tourism sectors. Campaigners believe the oil exploration plan in the Australian Bight is too risky.
We're fighting for the Bight and we're trying to get Equinor out of our Australian marine waters.
Please, Equinor, follow the lead of BP and Chevron and pull out. The Australian people have said no.
The federal government says the project will improve Australia's energy security and bring money and jobs to the region. Matt Doman is from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, an industry group. He says the drilling can be undertaken safely.
We understand there are a wide range of questions and concerns that exist in the community. We just urge a calm assessment, a fact-based assessment.
Earlier this month, Australia's offshore safety watchdog asked the Norwegian energy company to modify its drilling plan. Equinor said it's committed to meeting all regulatory requirements and intends to start exploration within 2 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, a Thai court acquitted the son of ousted former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat of money laundering in a case involving $328 million in loans extended by a state-run bank to a real estate developer. Thaksin, ousted from power by a 2006 military coup, was acquitted in the same case this year. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. A summit this week between leaders of Pacific Rim allies, South Korea and the Philippines, is expected to show that both lean toward the West rather than China, despite their efforts to get along with Asia's superpower, that according to regional analysts. Some scholars believe a swing toward the West by either country would hamper Beijing's Asian influence, where its military expansion alarms multiple governments, and it could give the United States a new opening to get involved in the region. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte said he is meeting his Korean counterpart at an Association of Southeast Asian Nations South Korea summit in Busan Monday through Wednesday. Asian security issues are expected to lead the discussion. Jeffrey Kingston is a history instructor at Temple University's Japan campus.
The Philippines and Korea both have been fairly accommodating of China because Korea, given its proximity, and Duterte because he wanted to make the best deals. Both of them are countries that feel concerned about the rise of China, both feel threatened.
Duterte broke ice with China in 2016 by setting aside a maritime sovereignty dispute and accepting pledges of $24 billion in Chinese aid. But Chinese activity in the disputed South China Sea, including a boat collision earlier this year, is worrying Filipinos. South Korea spars with China over ties with North Korea. The North, a Chinese ally, periodically tests missiles near the South, and in 2017, Beijing condemned the South for installing an advanced U.S.-backed anti-missile system. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. Coming up, a Thanksgiving holiday treat goes solar. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Fans paid their respects Monday to Gu Hara, a South Korean K-pop star who was found dead late Sunday. Attendees placed flowers below Gu's picture at the wake that was held in Seoul. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook for this and much more. We've got top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States is right around the corner this coming Thursday. Historically, it's meant big profits for cranberry farmers as the fruits of their labor appeared on traditional Thanksgiving tables across the country. Crashing prices over the past decade have sent farmers looking elsewhere to make ends meet. VOA's Arash Arabasadi dives into this holiday story.
Farmers have grown cranberries in this Massachusetts bog for generations. They say business today is not what it used to be.
It costs $32 a barrel, which is 100 pounds, to grow cranberries successfully. And right now we're getting paid $22, which is the same amount of money my grandparents got paid in the 50s to grow cranberries.
A long-time freefall in cranberry prices has some farmers looking for creative ways to earn a living.
And so that's where the solar project comes in, is that it's a different type of revenue stream.
In the United States, people using solar panels can sell surplus electricity back to the electric companies at a profit. Farmers have acres of land primed for solar panels.
My research tries to look at the whole production system, so we're trying to look at how these solar panels affect the microclimate underneath the solar panels.
The challenge for most farmers comes in harvesting power from solar panels that shade their crops.
Cranberries are an understory plant, which means that they grow underneath other types of plants. So their genetic need for a lot of light is much lower than for other plants.
Research is ongoing as to whether or not crops and solar panels can coexist. But some farmers welcome a solar harvest.
That's money that you can actually count on, that's real, that you know that you're going to get that money every single month. Whereas when you harvest the cranberries and bring them in, you really never know what you're going to get paid for them until about a year later.
The United States Department of Agriculture reports that cranberry prices sank almost 60% in the past decade. Ongoing trade disputes with Europe and China further strain farmers who once exported 30% of their product. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia. Pope Francis told political leaders in Tokyo that destruction like that created by the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki must never take place again in human history. He made those comments during one of his final events on his visit to Japan. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, has been a key witness in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. Sondland is a very wealthy Trump donor, and while the practice of awarding ambassador positions to wealthy political supporters is not new to either Democrats or Republicans, some lawmakers and presidential candidates say it's time to limit the practice. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain tells us more from the State Department.
Millions of Americans were riveted by the testimony of Gordon Sondland, the wealthy hotelier who President Donald Trump chose to be his ambassador to the European Union. Some lawmakers are focused on why Trump gave Sondland the coveted post.
You donated $1 million to his inaugural committee, is that right?
I bought a VVIP ticket to the inauguration.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It's a lot of money.
In an MSNBC Washington Post debate, presidential candidate for the Democratic nomination, Elizabeth Warren, called on her competitors to help end the practice of giving ambassadorships to political donors. Congressman Ami Bera has introduced legislation to limit the practice and strengthen career professionals at the State Department.
Historically, 30% of ambassadorships are political appointees, 70% come from the career ranks. So we set those as the limits. Now, we don't want to be overly restrictive to presidents. They can come to the Foreign Affairs Committee or the Senate Foreign Relations Committee if they, for some reason, need to go over that number. But we really think it's important to emphasize our career professionals.
Congressman Bera contrasted Sondland with some of the career diplomats who have testified in the impeachment hearings.
What specific diplomatic skills does he bring to the table? Contrast that with two other individuals that are in the news. Ambassador Bill Taylor, and Ambassador George Kent, and Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. These are career professionals, folks that have come up through the ranks, who have served the country.
Former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, made a passionate plea for support for American diplomats serving abroad.
Ambassadors are the symbol of the United States abroad. They are the personal representative of the president. They should always act and speak with full authority to advocate for U.S. policies. If our chief representative is kneecapped, it limits our effectiveness to safeguard the vital national security interests of the United States.
Yovanovitch is a 33-year career diplomat who was recalled from her post in Ukraine in May at the request of the president, though the State Department says she did nothing wrong. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
59 countries have elected female heads of state, but the United States has yet to shatter what former Democratic nominee for President Hillary Clinton called the highest, hardest glass ceiling. Clinton's loss to President Donald Trump in 2016 may have blazed a trail for five female candidates currently running for president in 2020. But as VOA's Brian Patton reports, it also reinforced doubts that a woman can actually reach the White House.
Looking back at her 2016 election defeat to President Trump, Hillary Clinton recently said gender stereotypes and sexism contributed to her loss.
There have been slights against women and all kinds of sexism and misogyny, so none of this is new.
Trump's treatment of women, from calling Clinton a nasty woman to regularly critiquing women on their physical appearance, combined with his anti-abortion judicial nominees and racially divisive pronouncements, helped spur a record number of women to run in last year's midterm congressional elections. Now multiple women are running for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. The contenders include three U.S. senators, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, California's Kamala Harris, and Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. All face an electability hurdle specific to their gender.
We have a certain archetype for president in this country. It has always been a man. We think of leadership, and particularly presidential leadership, in a certain way. And women don't fit into that yet.
Female Democratic candidates can be particularly vulnerable to gender bias attacks that cast them as overly compassionate and not as tough as men in advocating causes like expanded health care for the poor.
That probably reinforces existing views of the Democratic Party when sometimes to win that majority, you need to cut against the stereotype a little bit.
After the Clinton loss, some wonder if a male Democrat stands a better chance of winning over Americans who voted for Trump in 2016. But today's Democratic candidates reject any notion that now is not their time.
Putting more women in positions of power leads to progress. And it's not always easy, but you don't get what you don't fight for.
Another Democratic contender, former Vice President Joe Biden, recently criticized Elizabeth Warren as angry and unyielding. Warren responded in a campaign email saying, "I'm angry and I own it." Today's women candidates are not shy about calling out perceived sexist attacks or double standards in how they are portrayed.
I think it's opening everyone's eyes to, hold on, is that the way I would treat a male candidate? And that's good for all of us.
Recent elections indicate growing female support for Democrats, and polls show an erosion of support for Trump among women. Women will play a critical role in the outcome of the 2020 election, including whether a woman finally breaks the presidential glass ceiling. Ryan Patton, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the radio throughout Asia, like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. We'd like to say hello to everyone there listening today, and thank you for joining us. Come back again tomorrow. We'd also like to thank you for following us online. A lot of different places you can find VOA Asia, like YouTube, Instagram, VOA Asia Twitter, of course, VOA Asia Facebook as well. And you can send us a message. Just write to us, VOA Asia at voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Keith Holmes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and our interns, Hyong, Afra, and Candace. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.